Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it, believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call, did write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of some human malware to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Chris.
And wait, what the fuck? You're not Mark. Who are you and what have you done with Mark?
Did you not get the email?
What email?
Okay, so Mark's currently in the States and he's basically got an interview to become Kellyanne Conway's replacement as chief apologist to all television networks that aren't called Fox News.
Okay, that makes sense.
So he's asked me to come along instead.
Fair enough. And you are?
So I am Chris. You may know me from episode 37, where I set the questions for fake news. And I also play Man Asleep on a Plane on the film Nothing to Declare, which is another Jim and Mark production, which is available on all good YouTube channels. Well, Mark's YouTube channel.
Yeah, that's a fair description of your entire experience up to now.
Yes.
At least involved with us, anyway.
You've got me on IMDb, so, I am an actor, and I am therefore a professional.
Yes. So the true story is Mark is away this week. Chris is an old friend of mine, so this is a guest appearance.
Yeah, something like that.
Yes.
We'll see whether it actually ever gets repeated, whether I'm good enough to come back.
Or whether this even makes it to air.
Yeah. Oh, but fair enough, yeah. So, a logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. The logical fallacy we're looking at this week is the politician's fallacy. That's also known as the politician's syllogism. I had to look up how to pronounce that. And also the appeal to desperation.
So, yeah, the politician's fallacy is, I think it's a kind of specific version of equivocation, which is where a word is used in two different ways. The classic version of this fallacy is when politicians say, something has to be done, my solution is something, therefore my solution is what has to be done. And in the kind of equivocation way, something is being used in two different ways in that. So when you say something has to be done, what you're talking about is an effective solution has to be found. But when you say my solution is something, you're using something to mean just anything. It's not nothing. So by kind of comparing those two somethings, which actually mean totally different things, you're claiming that your solution is the right solution, regardless of actually whether it's effective or the right thing to do. Or
it's a bit like saying like something must be done, X is something, therefore let's do X, even yes. though X might not be the right thing.
Absolutely, yeah. So in our first example from Trump comes from a speech that he did fairly early on in his presidency, and he said this.
China's been taking out from $300 billion to $500 billion dollars a year. Billion, not million, billion. Think of what $500 billion is. We've rebuilt China. But now it's a different ballgame. Somebody had to do something with China. President Obama should have done it. President Bush should have done it. President Clinton should have done it. They all should have done it. Frankly, they all should have done a lot of things that we're doing right now. So if you look at it, nobody did it, so I'm doing it, and that's what's going to happen, and we're doing well. So now we're taking in billions and billions of dollars from China, when in the past, we never got 10 cents. We never got money. We never got anything.
So Trump is claiming that his tariffs, which were his solution to the problem that he identified of China taking billions of dollars out of the American economy, was the solution, because something had to be done. Someone had to do something.
He's and never really understood the concept something. Of what tariffs are, does he?
Really, no. He has no clue what tariffs are. He doesn't understand trade at all or trade deficits. He keeps saying, this is so many times he's said this, that China have taken $500 billion out of America, or that America has lost $500 billion a year to China. First of all, America has bought stuff from China.
Yeah.
So they paid the money, they got stuff. And it's never been 500 billion. The most it's ever been, when you only choose goods and not services, which China buys more services from the US than the US buys from China. But when you only take into account goods, the highest it's been is $419 billion in 2018, so while he was president. before that, the highest it got to was $375 billion. So, and that's not the US giving that money to China. They're getting something in return for it. So economists agree that trade deficits and trade surpluses are neither inherently good nor bad. It is very contextual and it depends on what the situation is. And obviously the reason is because in China they can afford to make things cheaper because of their probably very poor labour laws and other things that mean that they're able to produce
things,
goods.
Kind of glossing over
other
the whole human rights issue.
Concentration camps and, you know,
other things.
Like. Other things. That it's cheaper to buy stuff from China. So that's why people in America buy stuff from China, including Trump when he buys the ties and the hats and all that stuff from China. So by putting tariffs on Chinese goods, Trump is trying to make it more expensive for Americans to buy stuff from China, and therefore they will buy those things from America when actually there isn't the manufacturing base in America to make the volume of stuff that people buy from China. So it doesn't help. It also doesn't cost China anything because the people who pay the tariffs are the American importers and ultimately the American people when they buy the stuff, because the price is usually just passed on to the consumer. And he also says in that, because I know, you know, this is not necessarily specifically about the fallacy, but I always like to point out when he's lying. he said that we now take billions in from China and we never got any money from them before at all. It is true that in 2018, his tariffs raised the amount that the US Treasury got from tariffs on Chinese goods to $23 billion. But in the 7 or 8 years prior to that, it averaged around $12 or $13 billion a year anyway. So it was a significant increase, but it was absolutely not true to say that they never got any money from China, from tariffs on Chinese goods before. It's always been a lot of money.
Although I do have to say that obviously he's managed to get a little bit more, but as you say, the way in which it works is not he simplified it hugely, misunderstood it hugely, and is basically claiming credit for a whole lot of nothing. Yeah. A whole lot of not very much.
He also regularly claims that if the US didn't give China all this trade, which is why they're, you know, so scared by the tariffs, that the Chinese economy would completely collapse, which is complete bollocks, because the Chinese economy, their GDP is about $14 trillion. So even if it was $500 billion, it would be a significant chunk, but still a very small amount compared to the whole economy in China.
China's kind of a big country.
They
got quite a lot of people from memory.
Yeah.
And they've got quite a diverse economy now under the Winnie the Pooh lookalike. We're never going to China after this, are we? We're never going to be allowed in.
I'm going there. That's fine.
They
do well from lots of different countries. They're not reliant on the US for their economy. So
you kind of get the feeling they'd probably be all right.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if Trump decided, right, we're just not getting anything from China ever again, they'd probably still be okay.
So of course, the other thing we haven't mentioned, or you mentioned when you were explaining it, is of course, all that China did is then add a whole load of tariffs to a whole load of American goods, which actually made them more difficult to sell in China, which is, as we've kind of just explained the last couple of minutes, quite a large market.
Which is why Trump had to bail out the farmers, because they couldn't sell their soybeans and corn to China. And they have started, but now, buying large amounts of soybean and corn again. But the farmers suddenly lost a lot of where their agriculture was going. So a lot of that money that the Treasury got in from the tariffs, from the American people, went to bailouts of mostly large farms rather than the small farms that were struggling under the lack of money coming in.
Yeah, yeah. But that's Trump all over, isn't it? Help out big boys. Don't be so worried about the mom and pop small organisations, because nobody really cares about them. They're just small and insignificant. Absolutely. It's just the way it feels.
So, yeah, fallacy-wise, this was a clear case of Trump saying something had to be done about this. I did something that everyone else should have done what I did, because that was clearly the right thing, when all he did was something that wasn't especially effective and didn't address what wasn't even really a problem. So, yeah. Our second Trump example comes from an interview that he did with the Washington Post. He was asked a question about the Muslim ban, and he talked about the terror attacks in Paris. This was back in 2015, and in San Bernardino. And he said, "So I said something has to be done. So I said, we're going to call for a temporary ban on them coming in." So his response to the problem of terror attacks, some of which in the world are perpetrated by Muslims, was to ban Muslims as a whole, which is an extreme response and not necessarily appropriate, if I'm being quite kind. So, yeah, it was a something has to be done, this is something response.
Yeah, and the sad thing is, of course, although Trump kind of almost became the poster boy for all of this, if you can use that expression, this is something that you're seeing repeated around the world. The moment there does seem to be a bit of an issue with religion being used as basically to acts of terrorism around the world, and it's not just Muslims, it's all of the different religions, all at some time, have all used religion as a reason for having a war, basically.
I mean, it's one of the most common reasons, basically. It's usually either territory or religion, and often the reason that they think they have the right to the territory is religion.
Exactly. It just seems to be, our side, the one I believe in is fine, the one that you believe in isn't. As a complete nut atheist, I tend to think all organized religions are a bit strange, don't really have an awful lot to base on. So, it is a belief. So to therefore kind of have a whole set of rules based on a belief, to me, is quite bizarre. To then have even more rules to say that religion's right, that religion's wrong, is even more is another layer of bizarreness.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't quite seem right to say that every single Muslim is a terrorist, because they're not. They're very obviously not.
No, it's not. It's not even a hard question, really. It's not appropriate to target an entire religion or a race or any group of people for the actions of a small number of those people. Yeah, this was not an effective response.
We could always ban all presidents from now on, because one president's pretty awful.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a bad idea. It's worth a go. As a percentage, to be honest, the absolutely awful people is a much higher
number. Presidents are higher than... Yeah, ban the election in November.
Yeah.
Just don't bother.
And now is the time, I think, for Chris's British Politics Corner.
Oh, I get my own version of that.
It's bespoke.
I'm honoured. Yeah. I'm utterly honoured. Now, I know, because usually I think you and Mark spend quite some time putting these things together.
That's the impression we like to give.
I think you're probably at this point going, Chris, I don't know what you're going to talk about. And there's a reason for that. I'm kind of been keeping it in surprise. So really what I'm going to do here is I'm thinking, right, I'm here as a guest host. I'm probably only going to be here once, given the fact that I have a feeling that come November, Trump might not be around, and therefore this podcast kind of comes to a bit of a natural end. So
we'll see.
You might invite you back to the Christmas special, perhaps, but I have to do a good job first. So I just thought, right, I'm going to swing for the fence, although given this is the British Politics Corner, it's probably more apt to say six and out. So I am going to try and make the case that Brexit is a politician's fallacy.
Okay.
Now,
I'm in. I'm in. So.
Oh, that's a good start. So, I mean, I kind of look back in terms of, you know, 10, 15, maybe even 20 years ago, when Euroscepticism was kind of something that kind of rumbled a bit on the Tory backbenches. But, you know, that's basically where it stayed. And you kind of have to look at how or why did it go from being a bit of a right-wing kind of complaint, mumble-grumble, into something that became mainstream and something that therefore made 52% of those people who voted decide that actually they wanted to be out rather than in. Now, I do appreciate that Brexit means different things to different people, but to me...
Brexit surely just means Brexit, doesn't it? Yeah.
Depends on who you talk to. But to me, one of the key, I think the key thing that changed people's mind was immigration again. I know we've spoken about it just now, but in this case, it was one of those things that, you know, you go back to 2004 when you had the Eastern European accession countries being admitted to the EU. And in the UK, we allowed free movement right from the very start. And really, it's a question of thinking, you from then on, you begin to see the seeds of grumbling becoming much more vocalized, much more mainstream, much more politicized. Now, I think a lot of the politicians were probably either too scared or too media trained to kind of mention immigration specifically regularly, although there were examples of that, particularly during the Brexit campaign. You had that poster of Turkey. I think you've mentioned that on one of your previous podcasts, haven't you? The one where, you know, we're going to allow Turkey into the EU, and yeah, there were certain plays upon that. But the most of the damage, I believe, was actually something that was done by the media more than politicians. You look at how migrant issues, immigration, was a big topic on the front pages of many of the tabloids during the Brexit campaign. I've actually got some statistics here, and we'll put them up on the show notes just so that you can see where they come from. But the Daily Express mentioned immigration in a negative connotation 34 times during the Brexit campaign. The Daily Mail mentioned it 31
this
times.
This is the front page.
The front page.
The Express, yeah.
Exactly.
Because they mention immigration in a negative way in 34 times in every issue.
You're
right. It's not.
The front page, you know,
front
the
page headline.
Front
yeah.
page, the biggest block capitals that you can possibly see. The sort of thing that when every time you go into a supermarket or a newsagent or anywhere that sells newspapers, you know, you cannot help but see this. So the Daily Express 34, the Daily Mail 31, the Sun 15, Telegraph 12. I can kind of go on to some of the other ones as well. But, you know, it really was something that really, to me, I remember as someone who obviously voted to remain. The main reason I did that is because my wife actually is Eastern European, and I didn't want to get divorced from her. I kind of like her. I wanted her to be able to stick around. So, yes. But it is one of those things that I saw that frequently. I saw those headlines, and I think a lot of them were also false. A lot of them were not correct information. I mean, some of the things in terms of saying, you know, immigrants, you know, coming over here for NHS holidays, coming over mm-hmm. here for to claim benefits, coming over here, you know, all these negative things. And the numbers that are often put out seem to me to be grossly exaggerated. Now, I do still think that the Remain campaign at the end of the day was a pile of crap, and they did little to correct all the many fallacies and the many false false information, fake news, headlines and things plastered on the side of a
bus. I think the Remain campaign just kind of assumed that they were going to win without really trying. That's part of it, is they thought it was just so obviously going to be the status quo that was what people wanted.
that
they didn't have to do that much.
But I still look back upon this as to how did we get from, you know, that small beginnings to the point where we are now leaving the EU. And I do think immigration is front and centre. I do think the whole thing about, therefore, leaving the EU in order to control immigration is, in my opinion, an appeal to desperation, because something has to be done. Right, let's leave the EU, despite the fact that the EU does have many, many benefits, particularly economic benefits. But no, we're going to throw all of that out because we don't like the Eastern Europeans coming over here with their work ethic and taking our supposed jobs.
Yeah, or being really lazy and taking our benefits. Or they can't quite decide which one it is.
No, it's one or the other. I have to say, the work ethic joke is not mine. It is one that I've nicked off Have I Got News For You, and I can't remember the name of the comedian who said it. So I do apologise for that, but I just want to make sure that that credit is passed.
Credit's due.
Credit is credit due. It's not my joke.
Yeah, so, I mean, I agree, frankly. And I think that Brexit became a kind of something that solved a lot of different issues, chief among them immigration, but every part of the Leavers campaign kind of kept on bringing up new somethings that we need to do something about, like, you know, Brussels having control over our laws, and often complete nonsense and actual lies. But yeah, it was like, this is a problem, here's another problem, Brexit is the something that we need to do about it.
Does that mean I win?
I mean, that's not a competition. We're in this together. So
okay, fair enough. But yeah. I'll take that. Everybody wins. Everybody wins. But I concentrate on the immigration, but I think you're totally right. You know, there were so many other reasons. I was scared you were going to reject it, which is why I just went for the big one. But but yeah, I mean, there are, as you say, there are so many falsehoods, I believe, that were put out during the Brexit campaign. And you say, something needs to be done about this. I do acknowledge that the EU is not the greatest organisation in the world. And it does need some change. And it does need, probably even, you go as far as saying, reform. But to be out of it, to me, is a illogical, nationalistic thing, appealing to a small number of people, which became a mainstream due to misinformation and lies and unfortunate headlines on front pages of many tabloids.
So now it's time for the fallacy in the wild. Normally we would have a sting from Mark here, but obviously he's away. So Chris,
is he not done one?
No, he's not. No, he was expecting you to do one.
Ah, but I'm not in a band.
Yeah, but he's only a drummer.
Well, there is that. Apologies for the singing in advance. Not that Mark's fantastic at singing either, but I'm going a cappella, so this is going to be even worse. But it is actually quite a good segue into the first fallacy that I'm going to try and work on you, okay? Right. Deep breath. It's a fallacy. A fallacy in the wild. It's the finest fallacy the world has ever seen.
Okay.
Yeah, singing-wise, not great. But there is a reason why I've done a football chant. Because this time I went big with Brexit. I'm going big again. I'm going to take on the Premier League. Now, I also have to appreciate, Jim, it's not exactly your area of expertise.
No, you're going to need to... You're going to need to explain this in more detail than your Brexit one, because I was with you straight away for that. But this one, I know nothing about football at all, or soccer, And you're going to have to explain soccer, then explain the fallacy.
Explain soccer. It's a game with a ball and 22 men, and you kick the ball into a net and that could get a goal. And let's not go through that. I'm going to assume that people kind of vaguely understand the concept of football and the concept of professional football and really go on from there. It really starts in England specifically. And this is all going back to the 1980s when hooliganism was rife in the game. There were a number of disasters in which people went to football games and never came home. People were dying. It was some really nasty things were happening. Two big disasters that happened in the UK. There were Hillsborough and the Bradford fire. Really, really poor situation. Something needed to be done. The grounds were in a terrible state. The clubs were in a terrible state. Politicians were getting involved. And something had to be done. Now, that something began with six men, five chairmen, in fact, of football clubs, and one television executive. Because what they realised is that the amount of money that was coming into football needed to increase. It needed to increase to pay for stadium upgrades. It needed to increase to make the game more attractive to more people. At the time, football, the way football was shown on television, it was being they weren't getting enough money in. It was being undersold. And these six men realised that. And basically, that night, over the course of dinner, they had a profound impact on English football from there on. Now, I'm going to play a clip. It's from a documentary called The Night That Football Changed Forever. So not just me who thinks this. And the person you're going to hear from is someone called Irving Scholar, who is the chairman of Tottenham Hotspur, or as he was at the time. But it's quite an important element to this because it actually sows the seeds of how this whole situation in the Premier League helps out with this fallacy and the appeal to desperation.
Mansfield got as much as Manchester United, and Lincoln got the same as Liverpool, which in a sense was a bit daft because Lincoln and Mansfield weren't the clubs that the television companies wanted to show, but Liverpool and Manchester United clearly were.
So you can see there that what he's saying there is the big clubs deserve more money than little clubs. Now, I get that sport is a meritocracy, and if you do better, you should get more money. But as I'll explain in the next minute or two, they've gone well beyond that. So basically what they did is they sold the TV rights, and over time, we've now got to the point where the TV rights for football are worth billions. We're on about the fourth or fifth contract, and it's slowly increased from, it was around about 4 million at the time. It's now almost 3 billion. I mean, huge amounts of money has come into the game. But the Premier League is keeping the vast majority, and when I say vast, I mean really vast majority of it. So the actual amount coming in is 2.5 billion. So 2.5 billion is shared by 22 clubs. 140 million is given to the other 70. Now that is creating a massive disparity. And to me, that is an appeal to desperation, because actually what they're doing is they're looking after a small number of clubs and not giving a monkeys about those other smaller ones. To me, it's quite sad. And I'll explain why. This year, one professional club actually went into liquidation. It no longer exists. That club was called Bury. It went into debts of £9.7 million, which I accept is quite a lot. But at the same time, the top Premiership players, a single player, is earning £10 million plus a year. So you're thinking a club has gone out of existence for the wages of one player. And I also think the soul has been sucked out of football because it's now all about the money. With COVID, obviously there's no crowds coming in, and that's created a real issue for those small clubs that actually depend upon those people coming through the gate. These clubs in the Premier League, they get all that TV money. They're fine. But despite supposedly being fine, one club, Arsenal, they actually announced that they were in negotiations to give their top striker wages of around £250,000 a week. That works out £13 million, more than Bury owed when they went into liquidation. That same week, they also announced 55 redundancies of normal staff. I think the soul's come out of football. I think it all comes down to chasing money. And I think it's a small number of clubs. And that is why it is an appeal to desperation.
So football was in such a state and the grounds were in such a state that something needed to be done, basically, in the, when was this, the 80s?
Late 80s. Premier League was formed in 92. So this was all, but it's all late 80s, early 90s.
Late 80s, early 90s. Yeah. Okay. And the something they did was forming the Premier League to try and bring the money, well, more money into football as a whole.
Yes.
But then they gave it to...
But then they kept it.
Tiny amount of clubs.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can probably tell I don't support a team that's in the Premier League.
Was QPR in the Premier League at some point?
QPR were actually in the Premier League the year it was formed, and we were in the Premier League as recently as 5 years ago. Okay. Not for very long. We went up and then probably went straight back down again.
So this is not motivated by any bitterness or anything like that?
Well, actually, I mean, you've mentioned the team I saw at QPR. It used to be interesting. To me, you could, before all of this money came in, small clubs, you know, you could have a decent chance and you could actually perhaps win the FA Cup or, you know, and then they had a chance. You always felt you had a chance. Right now, I think the chances of my club ever winning anything again under the current regime is diddly squat to zero. And that, to me, again, sport should always be, yeah, if you try hard or you train hard or you have a little bit of luck, you should have a chance.
Yeah.
And under this, you really, really don't, because it's becoming a monopoly of super rich clubs. And another example of this is that they've actually formed this rule that if you have a decent youth player, and we have what's known as an academy, so a kind of a higher level youth setup, we can take your player for nothing. And of course, the only clubs that can afford the academies are those in the Premiership who have all that large amount of money. There are a couple outside, but the vast majority of the ones are the clubs that have been in the Premiership. So again, that chance to bring up a decent youth player and maybe he gets in the first team and makes a difference, that's being taken away from the clubs as well. And it was under the threat of removing that 100, if either you allow us to do this or we'll take away the 140 million. And that, again, it right. just shows it's all yeah. about us, the rich getting richer and putting on this amazing show that's broadcast around the world, but limited to 22 out of 92 clubs.
And then it becomes a vicious cycle that those ones are constantly getting more money, improving, getting better players.
Yep.
Okay. Well, I feel like I understood some of that, so that's good. That's a plus. Our final example in the fallacy in the wild this week is actually kind of the origin of this fallacy. Because, as you know, informal fallacies are the ones typically that didn't come from people like Socrates, but have built up over time. People have noticed things that people do and named them. And this clip from an episode of the British TV comedy Yes Minister was the first time that this exact formula was kind of noticed and put out there and is pointed to as the origin of it. So this is Sir Arnold and Sir Humphrey, two civil servants, discussing their ministers and the silly things they do when called on to actually deal with a problem. And in this instance, Jim Hacker, the Prime Minister, has come up with a solution to deal with the problem of local governments and local councillors getting a bit uppity and wanting more power.
It's the old logical fallacy. All cats have four legs. My dog has four legs.
Therefore, my dog is a cat.
He's suffering from politician's logic.
Something must be done. This is something, therefore, we must do it.
But doing the wrong thing is worse than doing nothing.
I love Yes Minister. I really do.
It's a great, great series.
I mean, the fact that it was 82, 84?
Yeah, yeah. That kind of era,
And then, of course, there was Yes Prime Minister, which followed on from it. But it is still so valid today, even though it's, what, 40 years old? Oh, my God.
Well, little changes in British politics over the years, I find. So, no, it is absolutely brilliant. And Sir Arnold there talking about my cat has four legs, or all cats have four legs. My dog has four legs, therefore my dog is a cat. That's kind of actually a slightly different fallacy. That's technically affirming the consequent, which is where you say P therefore Q, Q therefore P, which is kind of like if you said if it rained, the sidewalk would be wet. The sidewalk is wet, therefore it rained, which is not. It is a fallacy because there are other reasons that the sidewalk might be wet. And in the same way, cats have four legs. That doesn't imply that everything with four legs is a cat. But that's his statement. And I don't really see the connection between that and what they then describe as politicians' logic, which is something has to be done. This is something. There's kind of a link, but it's, as I say, I think it's more of an equivocation, really. But the interesting thing is, Sir Arnold says at the end there, sometimes doing nothing is actually better than doing something. And what has been found in research is that that's not necessarily the case. And there was an interesting study done in New York University by a guy called Patrick Egan in 2013, who looked at different political issues and what people's general consensus for what you should do about them would be. You have the status quo, how things are at the moment, and you offer two solutions to make it better, or changes at least, one of which is more of a left solution and one of which is more of a right solution. So, for example, if you're looking at the issue of the national debt, the status quo would be to keep taxes and spending the same as they are now. The left side would be to raise taxes, cut military spending, but keep health and education the same. The right side would be cut spending on health and education, keep taxes the same, but don't cut military spending. Keep putting money into the army, that kind of thing. So what you might expect is that if the population in aggregate, as a whole, is more on the left side of an issue like that, then if you're comparing the left-hand solution to the status quo, people would prefer the left-hand one. And if you're comparing the status quo to the right-hand solution, the right-wing solution, people would prefer the status quo because it's on the left side of that. But that's not actually necessarily how it works. And in lots of cases, in lots of different issues, what people actually prefer is a change. Even if, generally speaking, people skew more left on an issue, the consensus is either left or right is better than keeping it how it is now, which is kind of weird. And this was a study that was called Do Something Politics and Double Peaked Policy Preferences. Because
easy for you to say.
Yeah, they called it a single peak, basically, if most people prefer one over the other. But when you get a double peak, where the status quo is the least popular option, and actually people in general all prefer either a left or a right one, you get two peaks on different sides of the right-left divide. And yeah, it does seem that in some cases, with some issues, people prefer the idea of doing something, even if it is kind of against what you would expect their political views would be, as opposed to just doing nothing and keeping the status quo. So maybe the politicians who pick a something to do because something must be done are kind of doing not the right thing, but doing what people would like them to do, in a way. The consensus of the public may be that doing something, regardless of what the something is possibly better than leaving things how they are if the status quo isn't ideal. And when is the status quo ever ideal, really? So it seems like people are, and to be honest, it's probably why we, in both our countries, US and UK, continually swing between one party and the other. because it's never, you know, people are never happy with how things are. So they think, all right, well, let's try the other ones for a bit. essentially.
Sometimes we try them for too long, though.
Yeah. Sometimes just one term is too long. So
we're gonna play
fake news, folks. I love the game. It's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for fake news, the game where I read out three Trump quotes, two of which are real and one I made up, and Chris has to figure out which one is fake news.
So what's the current score? How's Mark been doing?
He is on 24 out of 56.
I see.
42%, I think, something
so,
like that.
So that's certainly, you know, he has improved over those early days, but obviously, you know, he needs to improve. So something needs to be done. So basically he's brought me in instead.
Yeah. Well, we'll see if that is the something that needed to be done. And, you are playing on Mark's behalf, so whatever happens here, it's not really on you. He will bear the burden of it. So,
you could argue, technically speaking, because he actually guessed correctly my suggestions. So I'm actually on 0%.
That's true.
Maybe I wasn't the best choice. Well, we'll see.
Well, you have the opportunity to bring that up to 50% with a single go.
Which is better than 42%.
Absolutely. So these statements are all from a mad phone call that Trump had with Fox and Friends when he was basically trying to draw attention away from the Democratic National Convention. And so he called into Fox and Friends for an hour and talked about all kinds of different weird stuff. Statement number one is when the Fox, the Friends, I don't know what they are, Ainsley and the gang, they said that Kamala Harris was against the wall, basically. And Trump said, "Those 280 miles I built have stopped like hundreds of thousands of people. Mexico is heavy, heavy COVID territory. They are highly infected. I built the wall and that wall has stopped people from coming in. If she said that, and I know Sleepy Joe said it, he said we should stop the wall and I might even tear down the wall. He wants to tear down a wall that's the best border wall ever built in terms of the success of it, in terms of the best ever built, he wants to tear it down."
Okay.
Okay. Statement number two. He said, "Amazon and other companies like it, they come and they drop all their mail into a post office. Not all of it, but a big percentage of it. And they say, 'Here, you deliver it, you stupid people. You deliver it.' And it costs us, every time they drop a package, it costs us like $3 to deliver the package for them. $3 a package. We're losing a fortune. I said, 'You've got to raise their rates. You're going to have to raise their rates.' But Amazon, they build their big plant always near a post office."
Right.
And statement number three. "What happens is I get other countries, other leaders, they call me up and they say, 'How do we talk to him? Because I have a good relationship with Kim Jong-un.' And they don't know how to deal with him, but I know. They say, 'You're the only one he listens to. Could you talk to him for us?' And you know, I hate to say it, but they're right. Nobody has a relationship with North Korea like I have. And they've been trying for years to figure out how to talk to him."
Okay. Three very different subjects.
It was a wide-ranging hour of ranting.
I do recall some of the bits being played out on British media. Unfortunately, none of these three were ones that I had actually heard.
I don't want to make it too easy for you.
It would be nice. So, okay, let's go back through the three quotes then. So the first one, he's kind of talking about the wall. He slips in his Sleepy Joe kind of nickname. He does love a nickname, doesn't he?
Nicknames are very big with Trump, yeah.
Yeah. So that also could just be your sneaky way of trying to distract me. He wants to tear down a wall that's the best border wall ever built. See, in some ways, that's actually the phrase that's kind of making me think that could be fake, because he'd kind of stayed away from boasting about the wall a lot recently, because, of course, it's not been the greatest success. But then he says the greatest wall ever built in terms of success. But he's still stupid enough to say that sort of thing. Okay, let's look at the other one. So he's Amazon basically using the post office. Now, of course, in this country, Amazon don't use the post office. They deliver them themselves. I don't know what the model is that Amazon use over in the States. Every time they have a package, it costs us $3 to deliver the package. Every time they drop it, we're losing a fortune. Amazon bill them. The bit that really bothers me there is, did he actually say, you stupid people? That's the bit that... That's actually really quite, even for Trump, that's quite extreme. Okay. Number three, okay, he's gone North Korea again. Nobody has a relationship with North Korea like I have, and I've been trying for years. That's the one that sounds most like, I think three is real. So therefore, I think it's a choice of choosing between one and two for me. So Sleepy Joe, stupid people. Did he say stupid people? I don't think he said stupid people. I think that's going a bit too far, even for him. So therefore, I think two is fake, because his main thing on the post office has actually been more about the postal vote. And I think he wouldn't have missed the opportunity to have a go at that rather than go on about Amazon. So I'm going to say that number two is the fake one. One and three are the real quotes.
Okay, well reasoned. So, of the other two, of one or three, the one that convinces you more is
three.
Number three, okay, and number three is fake news.
Oh no!
Sorry, that's the one I made up.
I hate you.
Fair enough. He
on behalf of Mark, said, I hate you.
He said something quite similar about Erdogan. The Turkish Prime Minister or President, but not about Kim Jong-un and not using those words. But he did claim that other countries call him up and ask him to talk to Erdogan for them, which, again, almost certainly a lie.
We sent him a letter.
Yeah. Speaking of lies, the other two he did say. So number one, here he is.
Those 280 miles I built have stopped hundreds of thousands of people. Mexico is heavy, heavy COVID territory. They're highly infected. I built the wall, and that wall has stopped people from coming in. If she said that, and I know Sleepy Joe said it, he said, we should stop the wall, and I might even tear down the wall. He wants to tear down a wall that's the best border wall ever built in terms of the success of it, in terms of the quality, the best ever built. He wants to tear it down.
So, I mean, where do you start? First of all, no, Joe Biden doesn't want to tear down the wall. He specifically said he doesn't want to tear down the wall. He said he will not build anymore. He'll stop immediately when he gets in. There will be no more wall built, but he won't tear down what's already done. It hasn't stopped hundreds of thousands of people coming in at all, by any means.
They just walk around the end of
those,
it.
Those 280 miles, at least 200 miles of that was already there. That was just repaired wall that had been kind of scheduled to be repaired and rebuilt. So the additional wall that he's built is kind of minimal, given that the border is hundreds, over 1,000 miles long. And also Mexico it is heavy, heavy COVID territory. They, in fact, just passed the UK in number of deaths, I believe. But compared to the US, they're actually lower in terms of cases and deaths per capita and just about every kind of measure. Except, it has to be said, case fatality rate. They are higher in that sense. But
the States is behind the world, don't forget, when it comes to cases.
Lower than the world, yeah. So much like crime, if they did let all the Mexicans into the US, they would lower the average rate of COVID. Yes, so that's it hasn't stopped people coming in. It hasn't stopped the spread of coronavirus. It's all big lies. Speaking of big lies, number two, it was also real. He said this.
Amazon and other companies like it, they come and they drop all their mail into a post office, not all of it, but a big percentage of it, and they say, here, you deliver it, you stupid people, you deliver it. And it costs us, every time they drop a package, it costs us like $3 to deliver the package for them, $3 a package. We're losing a fortune. I said, you got to raise the rates. You're going to have to raise the rates. But Amazon, they build their big plant always near a post office.
So that's not true. What Amazon do, they do use the post office for what is called essentially the last mile. What they do is Amazon ship their packages from their distribution centres to the local area where packages are to be delivered, and then the post office takes them the rest of the way, because lots of America has rural areas where it would cost an enormous amount for companies like Amazon to set up their own delivery for more rural areas. That's why they do it in this country, because we have less of those, you know, places where there's 11 miles between two houses and stuff like that. So they do use the post office. The post office charges them, and they don't lose any money on it. In fact, the parcels are the one bit of the postal service that is actually making money. And there is a law that says that the post office has to charge an amount that covers their costs to deliver parcels. And that is regularly checked. And when it's checked, they don't transgress that law. They charge Amazon just like they charge all other individuals and retailers and bulk retailers the cost that it costs them to actually deliver those parcels. They could arguably be making more because, yes, when it's a big, huge company like Amazon, they do a deal. But they are covering their costs. It does not cost them any money to deliver Amazon parcels. So, but Trump is saying it because he hates Jeff Bezos, because Bezos also owns the Washington Post. It's as simple as that.
that bit hadn't escaped me. But I'm still surprised he went as far as calling them stupid people.
Well, there you go.
well done. Thank apologies, you. Apologies to Mark. I'm still stuck on 0%. Where's Mark now on percentage?
He's now on 24 out of 57. That is still 42, because we're in the realms where you can lose a couple of goes and it's change your percentage much.
Well, that's right then.
But yeah,
perhaps I can come on next time and lose again, and he'll still be on 42.
Yeah. Well, no, that would bring it down to 41. It's time for the part of the show that this week at least is called Language is Not a Logical Fallacy, because I'm joined by Dr. Norma Mendoza-Denton, a professor of anthropology at UCLA, former president of the Society for Linguistic Anthropology of the American Anthropological Association, and she's one of the authors of the new book, Language in the Trump Era, Scandals and Emergencies. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us on Fallacious Trump.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me a bit about the genesis of this book. How did it all come about?
Well, this book came about because obviously in 2016, we were all surprised by the election results. And a whole group of us decided to put together a panel on basically linguistic things that we noticed around Trump's candidacy and Trump's, you know, first little bit of time in office. So we put together a panel at the American Anthropological Association, and everybody who went to hear the talks clamored for more and encouraged us to put it in as a volume. So we've done that, and very fortunate to be working with Cambridge University Press. And we have collected a group of 27 linguists who are exploring different aspects of language in the era of Donald Trump.
One of the things that you explore in the book, and we've talked about it on the show before, is Trump's quite frequent thing where he does something and then he claims he was joking, or sometimes he acts like he's just asking questions and not actually making a statement. And this is something that you term reactive reversal.
Correct.
Tell us a bit more about that. Why does he use that so much and what does he get out of it?
Yeah, so this is something that has been noticed and sort of spoken of in different ways as gaslighting, or I guess sending a trial balloon to see if that's going to work or not. So I've called it reactive reversal because really what it does is it's a discourse reversal based on the reaction that you get. Right. So first you stake a hyperbolic claim and you follow that up with logical extensions, and then a huge outcry follows, and that grows enough to become problematic for the administration. And then the retreat, the reversal part of it, is that once you have that reaction, you use plausible deniability and you reverse the claim and you say, oh, that's not what I meant. It's actually somebody else's fault, or even you made it up by inferring that information. And then you, you know, optionally could create some declaration of victory about whoever really claimed that he did what he originally claimed. So we see a lot of that even just in the past couple of weeks with the threat to not allow students to stay, international students to stay without a full with a full online course load, right? So that went up as a trial balloon that totally like 17 states sued the government, and then that was reversed. And that particular reversal didn't have it didn't have too much, I guess, publicity around the reversal part of it.
It does seem to be something that he does a lot. I mean, obviously, we kind of just see recurrent verbal tics and things that he just repeats again and again. Has his verbal style, his language use changed, do you think, since he started his campaign? Or has he always been like this? Is this something that he's kind of aiming specifically at the electorate?
Well, I think when he was younger, there's quite a lot of clips, audio clips and video clips of when he was younger. And he was using language a little bit differently. He used more complex sentences and words that were lower frequency, right? So a high frequency word would be a word like the, my, fantastic, great. Those are high frequency words in the language. Words that are lower frequency are more complicated words and longer words usually. So that has been a change from his sort of early adulthood or middle adulthood to now, is that his sentences are shorter and he uses more high frequency words. This is consistent with a lot of different interpretations. So some people would say that it indicates possible cognitive decline, but other people will try to make the argument that this is not the case at all. It's really astute delivery and recipient design. So he's understanding his electorate and designing speech exactly so it lands in exactly the right place for the people to whom he's trying to talk and appeal.
Yeah, so to what extent do you think he's kind of deliberately dumbing down, if you like, his speech to talk to a particular base?
I don't know if dumbing down is the right word, but definitely designing, like very carefully designing the speech so that, you know, he picks up different kinds of, some people call them dog whistles. He'll pick up different kinds of phrases and terms and throw them out there. So, you know, the looting starts, the shooting starts. Mm. And one thing that one of the authors, which I know you covered in your podcast earlier as kind of being reasoning by rhyme, or, you know, that, yeah, that logical fallacy of, you know, of basically poetics stands as my, you know, backup. But I think that all of these kinds of sayings are carefully designed either by him or by people on his team to be unpacked by different layers of the electorate. So I think that in fact it's just very deliberate and extremely smart.
Okay.
Unless we're completely wrong and it's just all going downhill.
Which is, yeah, it's possible. Yeah. So I mean that kind of language that he uses, it appeals to, I mean, he describes his own base or a section of it as poorly educated, so that group. But of course he also has the rich white evangelicals, mm-hmm, following him as well. Do they just ignore that part of it, or does it somehow appeal to them as well, the way he talks?
I think that it probably appeals to a wide swath of people, because we, you know, in America we have several different traditions that he's tapping into, and some of our authors allude to this. For instance, in his article, Get Them Out, Jack Sidnell talks about how, you know, when he's trying to work a crowd into these fervors of being a figure that they can look up to, he'll use these very pithy phrases, get them out, get him out. And then that picks up steam on its own, right? So get her out, get them out. And it's always, you know, it's always like a three-part kind of...
Yeah, lock her up and build the wall.
Yeah,
and kind of thing.
All of those things are related. There's a family relationship in those things. And they move crowds. They definitely move crowds. If you compare a Republican rally with a Democratic rally. I mean, there's no question to me that the Democratic rallies have these long kind of workers' rights types of multi-part call and response situations that are just not very audiogenic.
Yeah.
Whereas a very short and pithy statement just gets right out there. It's imminently repeatable. You don't need a whole lot to sort of remember about it or unpack it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Whereas the other ones are like, the people united will never be divided. Da, 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 da.
Yeah, the more nuanced kind of arguments do take longer to say, and they're not as chanty. So it is more difficult for people who are actually trying to back up what they say. Yeah. So in your essay about Latin America and messianic autocratic leaders, you talk about Trump's relationship with that kind of dictatorial or autocratic leader. He seems kind of obsessed with tough foreign leaders and like desperately wants to be that kind of masculine strongman. The thing that we find amazing here is that his followers seem to buy into it and see him in that as a masculine strongman. And yet he avoided the military and he's just got power because he's rich and that kind of thing. So how does he use language to achieve that? How does he kind of convince people that he is tough and one of these strongmen?
I think there's several strategies that are in use. One of them is just plain tough talk. So a lot of the time being tough is just really a discursive notion of, you know, what it means to put your foot down and to act tough in that way. So for instance, with the protests, the recent protests over the killing of George Floyd, it was reported that Trump took the governors and berated them over not being tough on the demonstrators and the protesters. And he routinely gets up on media platforms and says that we're going to be very tough with these people. We're going to root them out. And, you know, he makes it both a rhetorical device to talk about how tough he is, how he never cries, how, you know, all of these things that would appear to him to show weakness, like he absolutely protests that he's partaking in them. And then, of course, you know, he has to have his reactive reversal sometimes, like, oh, okay, masks are now patriotic. Right? But for a long time, you know, they were a sign of weakness. And so neither he nor Bolsonaro, until he, you know, got COVID, were doing anything about that. So I think that, you know, part of it is just a discursive construction on his part of toughness. And part of it is just imitating what he sees around him as being particularly ruthless. Like all of the praise around, you know, Kim Jong-un, and I mean, just head scratching.
Yeah.
That he would do stuff like that. Yeah.
It is bizarre, especially I think when it's coupled with the disdain that he seems to have for European leaders who he sees as weaker or just in some way, you know, people who are very successful in their own countries like Angela Merkel, but, you know, not his kind of leader, I guess. It is odd. Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of the book was written kind of pre or in the early stages of coronavirus, or at least it went to press at that point. Do you think has his messaging around coronavirus done anything different from what he was doing before, do you think? Or is it just carried on themes that he already explored, just using new terms? I'm thinking particularly of kind of his insistence on calling it the China virus and things like that, as opposed to following the scientific names.
I mean, in some ways, it's what we've seen now is an even more exaggerated version of some of the verbal patterns that he was exhibiting earlier, of, you know, trying to float out these trial balloons and then reverse his stances when it doesn't work, insisting on versions of reality that cannot be backed up. One thing that he did a little bit earlier on that seemed to me to be incredibly self-aware, that I had never seen him exhibit that type of self-awareness, was early on when the coronavirus deaths were climbing, and he kept saying, it's going to get better, it's going to get better, it's going to get better. He was cornered. And eventually he said, well, I have to be the cheerleader. I have to be the one giving the positive spin on this. And I thought, wow, okay, that is the most self-aware thing I've ever heard him say. Like, it's not that I'm telling you what's happening, it's that I have to put a good spin on it because I am leading the fight. So I thought that that part was, I mean, not endearing exactly, but definitely seemed to think that he's doing his best.
He certainly thinks that, yeah.
Yeah, it may not be what's necessary at this point, but definitely doing you know, what he can do.
One of the things he started trying to do now, kind of, I think he's doing more and more, is trying to draw attention to Joe Biden's kind of failings of language use and bit kind of stumbles over words and things like that, which seems to me like a dangerous strategy for someone like Trump, who, I mean, there's a lot more examples that we can point to of his, but
yeah,
it seems like Trump is far more guilty of all of that stuff than Biden.
Yeah, but, you know, by using a strategy of distraction, you can get pretty far. by saying, oh, not me, that guy over there, you know, Sleepy Joe or whatever his, you know, latest moniker invention is going to be. Like, that appears to be what draws the laughs. So many of our authors have made the claim that a lot of Trump's entire persona is performative. Right. So as long as he's performing circus master or WWE ringleader, or, you know, people are trying to slot him into that kind of frame where he's telling them how to interpret the situation. And, you know, he's sort of announcing the different characters and extracting from them what he believes is going to help him. So these very long and elaborate rituals that he has of having people thank him and acknowledge him when they come into a room in his presence.
Yeah, and some of the cabinet meetings where everyone has to go around and say great things about him before they start.
Yeah, have you ever seen that?
It's amazing. It's kind of, yeah. It really does seem like a kind of North Korean type thing. You know, the everyone praising dear leader before they can get to debates.
So you praise a dear leader, and if you don't do it right, you can be excommunicated.
Uh-huh.
Right? Or at least not invited to the health briefing.
Yeah, it's quite amazing.
Yeah.
One of the theories put forward in the book, I think by Janet McIntosh, is that there's actually a risk of the left focusing too much on the failings of Trump's language, the kind of the misspellings and the mistakes he makes. Mm-hmm. Where is that risk? What is the problem with doing that and the danger in doing that?
Well, you know, I think the American electorate has shown that being highly educated is not necessarily like a good thing or anything that will get you a bonus in American politics. So for a long time, George W. Bush did quite well playing the guy, you know, I mean, whether it was a sort of put on persona, but he definitely played like the good old boy who loved to drink and until he had to quit and, you know, was quite the rabble rouser in college, and then he wound up becoming president. So people didn't expect that much from him. And I think that if on the left, people continually point out the tiny, tiny things, people on the right are able to just ignore that and say that that's not why they voted for him. Right? They didn't vote for him to be on the National Spelling Bee, which clearly he couldn't be. But you know, they are placing their eggs in a different side of the basket, as it were. They've elected him to stand up for gun rights. They've elected him to spank the Democrats as much as possible. And they've elected him to do other things like, you know, pro-life positions and pro-police positions and stuff like that.
It also seems at times like his difficulty with language in a way is a plus. It is the thing that makes them feel like he's one of them which that's a weird thing for us. Like, we can't quite get our head around the fact that this guy in the penthouse with the gold toilet is seen as an everyman and one, and you know, blue collar president in a way.
And that's why it's so brilliant.
That lack of highfalutin speech seems to bring him down to their level in a way. That's quite amazing that he's managed to achieve that, at least.
Yeah. I think for a lot of people, the paradox of people voting against their own interests, you know, it stands. It's such a paradox that you would select somebody who, you know, who promises to kick out all the illegal immigrants, but you happen to be married to one and you never think this would happen. And then, boom, he does it. Yeah, you know, people will vote in ways that are still a mystery, and that's why we can't quite get a handle on what's going to happen next.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing.
I think for us, the sort of the most that you can hope to achieve with a volume like this is to try to show people how to identify for themselves and that's what you guys do in your podcast, when they hear a flight of fancy or a logical leap. People will be able to identify, like, didn't you just say the opposite last week? Didn't you just continue to say that Obama was born somewhere else when he showed you the birth certificate not that long ago, again and again and again? Or how is coronavirus Obama's fault? Like, we want people to be able to understand the discourse processes. And I think that's what you're doing in your show too. I'm a big fan.
Well, we certainly try, yeah. And there is a chapter in the book on gaslighting and all of the lies and falsehoods and the prevarication that he goes through on a daily basis, multiple times a day. It's quite stunning. So, yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating book, and the number of different brilliant professors that have contributed to it and have come at it from different and really interesting angles makes it a really good read, in my opinion.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for joining us. Where can people get hold of the book?
People can go either to the Cambridge University Press website or to Amazon to order it.
Excellent. And it's Language in the Trump Era, Scandals and Emergencies.
That's right.
Dr. Norma Mendoza-Denson, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you very much for having me. Take care.
And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
It was the Republican National Convention last week, and this year's theme was Things That Aren't True. After night one, Fox's Steve Doocy said,
at least one TV network last night was live fact-checking the RNC. Somebody would say something and they'd go, oh, hold on a second, that's not true. They did not do it last week for the Democrats. So what does that tell the viewer?
Which is a great point. It's just not the point he thought he was making. Many people are saying Don Jr. looked like he'd taken a lot of cocaine before his speech, presumably to help him keep up with his girlfriend Kimberly Guilfoyle, who yell-screamed all the way through her speech like Animal from The Muppets. Small-faced, bobblehead Charlie Kirk did some Olympic-level cherry-picking when he claimed that if you only look at C-SPAN's online streaming viewing figures, the first night of the RNC was six times more popular than the DNC. Everyone from Larry Kudlow to Mike Pence talked about coronavirus in the past tense. And Pam Bondi, the former Florida Attorney General who dropped an investigation into Trump University days after her campaign got a $25,000 donation from the Trump Foundation, gave a speech about how corrupt Joe Biden is and how nepotism is bad, which was immediately followed by a speech from Trump's daughter Tiffany, and then later One Way Eric, before Melania closed out night two by saying that America deserved total honesty from their president, which is weird because I thought she was supposed to be on the Donald side. Finally, it wouldn't be a Trump event without some good old-fashioned law-breaking. And sure enough, there were multiple violations of the Hatch Act, with Mike Pompeo addressing the RNC during an official trip to Israel, and Trump pardoning someone and then performing a naturalisation ceremony during the campaign event. At least two of the women involved in the ceremony were not told in advance that they would be taking part in the convention, but Trump never worried about getting consent from women in the past, and damn it, he's not about to start now.
In other news, the CDC have changed the guidelines yet again on who's getting tested, just to make Donald look good. After all, it doesn't matter whether you've got it or not, it's only about whether you've been tested. The new guidelines raise the bar on who should get tested, advising that some people without symptoms probably don't need it, even if they've been in close contact with an infected person. The kicker on all of this? This was all changed whilst Anthony Fauci was having an anaesthetic and was actually having a minor operation. Just because the scientist is asleep doesn't mean science stops.
The Democratic National Convention was such a contrast to the RNC that I had to check my cognitive bias. Can they actually be so amazingly different in tone, content and quality, or am I just looking at them through rose-tinted radical leftist glasses? Well, yes, they can be that different. Barack Obama spoke, and it was so refreshing to remember what a real president sounded like just for a few moments. He, and later Michelle, spoke about the stakes of this election with genuine concern about the prospect of four more years of Trump. Donald attacked Michelle, because of course he did, for taping her speech instead of doing it live, saying, "It was taped a long time ago because she had the wrong deaths." Yes, Trump was complaining that Michelle Obama had only credited him with more than 150,000 deaths, when the real number is much higher. Jill Biden spoke about what kind of man Joe is, with anecdotes about their life together. That kind of thing was dramatically absent from Melania's speech or any of Trump's children's, because as we know, he is an awful, awful person.
And Trump has also backed yet another supposed therapeutic cure for COVID. In this case, the cure is oleander. The oleander plant is highly toxic and consumption of it can be fatal. After you, Mr. President.
I have to say on this one, the interview that Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy, gave on Anderson Cooper's show was amazing. Mostly because Anderson Cooper just wasn't taking any shit about it. and the MyPillow guy, who is the one who introduced this to Trump, he has some stake in the company that is selling this cure, this miracle cure. He said, you know, why would I do this? Why would I risk my reputation? And Anderson Cooper was like, well, for money. Plus, you don't have much of a reputation. It was just brilliant. Blotchy white supremacist Steve Bannon, who these days looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger wearing Steve Bannon as a disguise to try and sneak onto Mars, has been arrested for his part in a fraudulent fundraising project called We Build the Wall. Bannon, who, as Josh Gondelman said, looks like the final boss you have to fight to free Willie Nelson from a dungeon, reportedly used hundreds of thousands of dollars of border wall donations for his own personal expenses, which I assume largely consisted of skin cream and KFC. I've actually lost count now of how many of Trump's campaign team and White House staff have been indicted on federal charges, but it's more than you would hope of a sitting president. No word yet on a pardon for Bannon, who somehow looks like cirrhosis and herpes had a child who grew up to be a used car salesman.
Donald Trump has also called for himself and Democratic challenger Joe Biden to submit drug tests before their first debate next month. Apparently, Trump believes that there's been a sudden improvement in Biden's performance in a Democratic TV debate and thinks that, therefore, Biden must be on drugs. I'm just wondering whether the drug tests will include hydroxychloroquine or whatever keeps his skin orange.
A new report from the Inspector General's office has offered up some details about Sean Lawler, the former Chief of Protocol. The Chief of Protocol is responsible for overseeing diplomacy with foreign nations and enforcing rules of decorum and etiquette. But remember, Lawler was Trump's Chief of Protocol, so you'll probably be slightly less shocked to learn that the IG's office characterised his tenure as an environment of yelling, cursing, over-consuming alcohol and intimidating and abusive behaviour. According to the report, Lawler routinely made abusive, homophobic and culturally insensitive comments to his subordinates, called a group of visiting Turkish nationals dirty and disgusting, and said that a group of visiting Japanese diplomats looked like gay porn stars and that he thought he was getting hit on and didn't want their gifts. Trump really has a knack for hiring the best people.
And in British politics, finally the Liberal Democrats have elected a new leader. Well, it's kind of the leader that was already there. It's got Ed Davey. On the day of the announcement, the BBC website obviously put up a headline to say that he'd been elected. However, I'm not saying the Liberal Democrats have become irrelevant. But on the same day, Boris Johnson announced that he brought in a personal trainer because he thought he looked a bit porky. That page had more hits and stayed on the front page of the BBC website for much longer.
Vitally important information.
By 6 o'clock in the evening, Ed Davey had gone and Boris Johnson, having a personal trainer, was still on the most read section.
So, that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this episode. You can find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com, and if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you've had a good time, then give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump. Just like our Strawman level patrons, Schmutz, Mark 5293, and Amber R. Buchanan. And our true Scotsman level top patron, Lauren.
You can connect with those awesome people as well as us and other listeners in the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallacioustrump.
All music is by The Outbursts and was used with permission. But that is Mark's band, so he's giving permission for himself to use his own music. Never mind. So until next time, it's been a blast for me. Thank you very much for listening. But next time on Fallacious Trump, Mark will be back, but we'll leave the last word for today to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.